I read the following this past week in an email signature. I acknowledge that the land I live and work on is the traditional land of the Ojibwa and Dakota nations. It's a poignant reminder for those of us of European descent that Native Americans were and are an important part of life here in western Wisconsin, and First Nations people are stepping up to preserve their heritage while educating their people and the rest of us regarding issues like tribal sovereignty, mascot reform, and historic racism. Today, Native American heritage, past, present, and future on the West Side. Good morning, I'm Dean Kallenbach. Glad you could join us on this Monday, December 2nd. Joining us for our first segment is journalist Paul DeMaine of Hayward, who for 33 years published news from Indian country from his offices at the Lukuturay Reservation near Hayward. He is Ojibwa by descent and an enrolled member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. Later this hour, we'll hear from UW Stout student Ariana Bourdon. She is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, who's president of the campus's Native American Student Organization. And for our final segment this hour, we'll hear an interview our producer Catherine Thomas did with Wendy McCoon's genius, an associate professor of languages at UW-Eau Claire, who teaches Ojibwa at the school and makes those lessons available online in an effort to keep the language alive. As usual, we'd like to hear from you this hour with your questions, comments, or stories. Call 800-228-5617. So we open with Paul DeMaine. And Paul, you were the original publisher and editor of News from Indian Country, which started 33 years ago and published its last issue in August of this year. Welcome to the show.
Thank you much from wintry northern Wisconsin this morning.
Yeah, you're digging out.
We certainly are. I mean, it came in hard and heavy, and it's here, so we'll be happy with it. We'll get the snowshoes out and the snowmobiles and all that and try to enjoy it now.
Well, I want to take a couple minutes in the time we have with you to talk about News from Indian Country. Talk about how the paper started and how it developed through the years, if you would.
Well, you know, actually, News from Indian Country started with a jump start from the Lukuturay Ojibwe tribe. I had been editor of the newspaper, the Lukuturay Journal, for approximately 8 to 10 years before I was asked by Governor Anthony S. Earl to join his administration as his native policy advisor and liaison. And I did that from 1982 to 86. When I came back to the Lukuturay Ojibwe Reservation, the tribe was thinking about defunding the newspaper. They had given it to WOJB as an add-on to their news gathering activities at the station at the time, and the WOJB news crew, being attuned to radio, wanted to focus on that. So they were looking at a way to find someone to reinvigorate the newspaper, and at that time we purchased some of the assets of the Lukuturay Journal, including the database of subscribers, and in return for servicing the prepaid advertising base and the subscription base that was there. And we launched News from Indian Country along with four other partners at that time, including the late John Bodine, who was an attorney out of Madison, Wisconsin, and a Ho-Chunk tribal member. Married to a Ho-Chunk tribal member. He was a member of the Lukuturay tribe. Nevertheless, he was kind of a background on the business end of that. I was the news guy, and then we brought in other partners in Wisconsin. Bob Preer out of Wausau, who was a businessman and a descendant of the Lukuturay tribe. Karen Lincoln Mijel, who I think is now the editor of one of the magazines in Madison. I'm not sure which one. Everyone's still involved in these kinds of activities, but it was the launch of News from Indian Country, and eventually we were serving we had subscribers or store sale outlets in every single state in the United States, and we had subscribers in all of Canadian's provinces of 22 other countries, New Zealand, Germany, Australia, all over the world. So we had a far reach at the height of our newspaper around the year 2000, which was the year that we did the most business. And then we had the onset of the internet. We were learning how to code HTML at that time. So we've covered numerous issues of geographics, of history of treaties, of social issues, political issues in Indian country, running up and down the United States, and certainly the Mississippi Valley, and what's happened in western Wisconsin and eastern Minnesota over the years.
Talking to Paul DeMaine, who has been a journalist covering, he's a Native American journalist covering news about Native Americans, and I would also ask you, Paul, in my years at WPR, we found that news from Indian Country was a critical resource to check our own reporting, and I've always felt the word "from" in the paper's title made it particularly useful to non-Indians as well as Native Americans. Was that the intent all along?
Well, it was really to give voice. I graduated from Wausau West High School in the 1970s, and at a time when the Associated Press and other news avenues were picking up, for example, Wounded Knee and some of the activism of the Indian community. And there was a publication out of New York published by the Mohawks called Akwesasne Notes, who had in-depth articles and interviews. And I thought the difference between in-house tool, it was a nonprofit entity at the time, was so much better than the short little blurbs that people were able to put together for the Associated Press and other entities. And there's always issues of sensitivity, issues of nuances that non-natives don't know, tribal affiliations. For example, your introduction was great, but a lot of people assume that since I live on the Lakotari Ojibwe Reservation, there have been journalists over the years who have described me as a member of the Lakotari tribe without asking.
Right.
I am a member of the Oneida Nation and of Chippewa descent, and I have relatives scattered throughout Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota on the Ojibwe side. So there's those little things that bug the perfectionist, and the people who read it in. Other people can get by and they don't know any better, but to me, the clarification, which is even continues today. I mean, even though the internet has put news from Indian Country out of business to some extent, it's the question about whether or not the information is good, factual information that you find on the net. So I think there's going to be a cove for people who verify and qualify the information and make sure that it's good in the future. I think right now you can get everything from good, bad, and ugly and fake news online. So It's a challenge we have.
Yeah, it's a challenge for all of journalism, of course, and particularly in the areas like you're describing. You know, we had originally set this show up for last week, which would have placed it within Native American Heritage Month, which is November. We ended up postponing to this week in order to cover the evolving situation regarding some racial tensions on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. So even though November is over, we're still going to talk about heritage. But I don't want to go too far back. You've been in a position to essentially do the play-by-play of American Indian history for the past four decades.
Right.
You mentioned Wounded Knee, but what are the most important stories you've covered, and how have they changed the lives of Native Americans here in western Wisconsin?
Well, I've covered all kinds of things. I mean, I think part of it was taking care of our own laundry. So I had to cover issues of crime and theft and all the things that go with covering your own community, from murder to the very, very positive things over the years. But here's what I found out in my experience covering indigenous affairs in Wisconsin just by itself. The geography of history is unbelievably rich. So let's talk about UW-Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. Well, right in the middle of the campus is a treaty tree.
Right.
It was knocked down a few years ago in a storm, but it's still got a plaque. But when I was going to school there, that tree still existed on campus. It was the place where the Ojibwe and the Dakota, the demarcation line between their territories, the Dakota to the south and west, the Ojibwe to the north and east, signed and agreed that there was a boundary. That's fascinating. It's got a whole history. It's got photos. There's documents that came from that place. Down in the La Crosse area, there's, One-Eyed Decora. There's a monument there. And the thing is if you get off of the nation's freeways and travel on Highway 12 and Highway 14, both that came out of Chicago and ended up in Minneapolis or thereabouts, those are historic Indian trails. So when you follow 14 out of Minneapolis or 12 out of Minneapolis, you're weaving amongst all the Ho-Chunk communities from Menominee Falls to Eau Claire to Fairchild to Black River Falls to the Dells to Lake Delton to all the way into Chicago. It's filled with old monuments, old village sites, and new village sites of the Ho-Chunk Nation. And then you get into, you know, talking about, we did some workshops at UW-Eau Claire at one point. We went out to Goshall, which is the old Kickapoo Valley area. And you ask the question, why do they call it Kickapoo Valley? Because the Kickapoo Indians live, you know, around Eagle Pass. They live under the bridge there. There's some trust land on the Texas side, but a good portion of them are on the Mexican side. They speak Kickapoo, they speak English, and they speak Spanish as well. Those people are all from the Kickapoo Valley originally. So what really interests me is less than some of the investigative things that it did that were proper in regards to Western Wisconsin. It has to do with the history of it, the Cahokians and the mound builders,
right,
and the people that came before, even the battles, the Stack and Fox and the Mascouten and all the other tribal people that were there. Rich in history, and yet when you look at the history of that area, it kind of like discovers with Discovery 250 years ago, even though the history is 20, 30, 80,000 years old in some cases.
One story that brought Native American sovereignty to the forefront in the 1980s was the treaty rights decisions relating to harvesting wildlife and later gambling in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Now, I was covering those stories as a journalist in Rice Lake, Wausau, and Menominee during that era, and they had a big impact on the region in general. I imagine that impact was really felt among the First Nations people in this part of the state.
Well, it is, but it's an evolving history in which we're beginning to, I think, regain lots of things. We're working on regaining our language, which is beautiful, whether it's Ojibwe or Ho-Chunk or Menominee,
mm-hmm,
or Potawatomi. I mean, you got Potawatomis in your area as well. Let's take a look at some of the history of the treaty rights. When I went to work for Governor Anthony S. Earle, part of the reasoning was behind it because he seemed to be open to new ideas. One of the new ideas was he was the head of the Department of Natural Resources at that particular time, and Ho-Chunk members who were members of the Madewin faith had been getting arrested on a regular basis for harvesting deer for their medicine lodge dances in the Jackson County area, from
mm-hmm
my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think Earl understood that under the religious freedoms that non-Indians had at that time, because it wasn't until the 1980s that the Indian Religious Freedom Act was passed, which then gave a cloak of protection to Native religious experiences and sites, he negotiated with the Ho-Chunk people the right to be able to take deer without fear of being arrested and having the deer confiscated, having your gun confiscated, being put in jail, bond, all the things that go with being arrested for doing illegal things. In this case, these were religious-based activities, and I think Earl saw the light at the end of the tunnel and says, you know, if they go into court, they're probably going to prevail on the right to take these deer as part of their feasting process in the medicine lodge. And so he negotiated an agreement in the Ho-Chunk, provided the basis for what they were going to do. Certain elders were going to, you know, make a decision they needed to deer. They were going to go to the DNR. They were going to get a permit and allow some people to go out and exercise that right to do that. Certainly the Ojibwe case was much more dramatic because in the end result, they have co-management or management rights over 50% of the resources because they have a right to gather
mm-hmm
that. Over 5,000 products in the woods, you know, and someone says, oh my God, it sounds like just about every plant and medicine in the woods that exists in northern Wisconsin is on the list of plants and medicines that the Ojibwe use. And the answer is yes, indeed. And so it was a good, great inventory, but you have to revisit that inventory to look at it and ask, what were they doing with ironwood trees, you know, because it was both medicine and wood building.
Mm-hmm.
So that case was pretty dramatic in terms of its potential impact to the state because the state had tried to act like those treaty rights didn't exist anymore. And, of course, there was additional fishing rights case on Lake Superior. There was elk hunting rights out in the Montana. There's salmon rights and whale taking rights in the West Coast. So across the nation, there was lots of litigation in which they went back and read the treaties and found out what they said. They didn't say, As long as the grass grows and the wind blows, or 60 days, whichever come first, it was forever these rights to hunt, fish, and gather, because our elders were saying, if we're going to give the U.S. government use of the land for settlement, how are my great-grandchildren going to feed themselves? And they were forward-looking, and I think we're trying to get back to that forward-looking now in terms of our response to fossil fuels and environmental issues. But it all goes back to the fundamental relationship that tribal people have with those products. Our communities are much more dependent on them. And so when you say those cases were earth-shattering, well, they were earth-shattering, but they were always part of our rights, and we remembered that. And I think it's important to see the world in the context of it. When you go to college, you should be getting into a course that talks about state, county, tribal, and national politics. You don't need a special Indian studies course on treaty rights or tribal government. It should be integrated into the framework of everything that's happening. When you study music in college, you should study indigenous music. When you study linguistics in college, you should study indigenous linguistics along with it. It doesn't need to be segregated, because what it is part of today's society. It's part of the past. It's part of the future. And so we need to integrate it in, so that everyone in Wisconsin understands that there are treaty rights, and there are treaty rights that have been reserved to the indigenous people because they were aboriginal and here before anyone. You know, I was appalled at the heading in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That's where journalistic indigenous journalists can help out. The Milwaukee Journal, after the court case, says, judge gives unlimited hunting, fishing, treaty rights to Indians. Well, number one, the judge didn't give them anything they didn't already own. Number two, it wasn't unlimited. It had to be regulated. You aren't going to see Indians shooting the last deer running in the state of Wisconsin down Main Street of Milwaukee, because it needed to be regulated, and it just wasn't Indians. It was Ojibwe Indians. I'm a member of the Oneida Nation, and I don't get a right to hunt or fish under Ojibwe treaty rights in northern Wisconsin. So you had three major errors in the headline of the main largest mainstream newspaper in the state of Wisconsin, because the headline writer didn't know facts from fiction.
You made reference earlier to the this will be my last question. I know you are short on time, but you know, the challenge we all have is with what's the source of your information. And the example you just used of the headline from the Journal Sentinel from the treaty rights decision, you know, demonstrates that, you know, even as journalists who are well-trained, if we don't understand the cultures that we're dealing with or all the circumstances that we're dealing with, we're going to make some mistakes. Are you concerned that the absence of news from Indian country is going to leave a vacuum in coverage where we did have the Paul Domains of this world to lean on to help us through that sort of that sort of nuance?
I'm not really worried about it, because when I first became a member of the Native American Journal Association, and I was the founder of the Unity Coalition, which is Black, Hispanics, Native, Gay, and Lesbian journalists. It was a coalition together. When we first started the Native American Journalists Association, there was like about 30 members. At the height of it, I'm going to say 15, 20 years ago, we had over 700 members. There's a whole new era of writers, storytellers, poets, photographers, investigative journalists that are out there. And I really have a lot of confidence that those young people are going to emerge into the market and replace the Mies and the news from Indian countries. Some of it was just fatigue after 33 sure. years, and actually my writing career started before news from Indian country did. So I've been doing this for 40-some years. There's wonderful young people that are percolating up that are going to take over. And with the help of other people who remember the 10,000 years of history in La Crosse and Menominee and in Hudson, where there's Iphigenia mounds on the cliffs, with the help of other people interested in preserving those things and people who are interested in discovering the oral history and the geography of the area, I think a lot of our history is going to be put down on paper and steadfastly used. There's a lot of mysteries out there yet, because the history is 10,000 years old compared to the U.S. government and United States being here for 200 and some years, and discovery, you know, taking place in 1492. That's a short history. It's a blink in the eye. Yeah. So we got a long trail to walk together yet. And I think we can do it in a way that finds beauty in the things that are left, those mounds, those cemeteries, the panthers, and the other archaeological things that we left. And we can still learn a lot of things from each other. But, you know, Western Wisconsin has a really unique history between even the recent ones, all the battles between the Dakota and the Ojibwe, battles in which they camped next to each other during the winter and played snow stakes. And then when spring came, they says, well, we'll have your hair the next time I see you in the scalp. You know, sorry, but we're at war with each other. The discovery of those kinds of stories are just intriguing in terms of the past history and how they worked together and fought with each other, but nevertheless, I guess, acted like human beings all along.
Paul DeMaine, thank you for joining us. I know things are busy there, and appreciate it, and also appreciate the great work you've done over the last four decades in reporting and providing journalism to people throughout the country. So thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it. You take care. We got to go shovel out now.
Okay. Enjoy that. After the break, we'll be joined by president of the Native American Student Organization at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, Ariana Bordon. You are encouraged to join the conversation at 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is the Ideas Network. We're joined now on the west side by Ariana Bordon. Ariana Bordon, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. Ariana is president of the Native American Student Organization at UW-Stout and was very involved in the Native American Heritage commemorations that happened on that campus in this past month. Talk about the organization, if you would, Ariana, and how long it's been around.
It hasn't been around that long, actually. But our Native American Student Organization, we aim to promote and instill awareness about Native American culture in the community and at UW-Stout. And then we also create a welcoming and supportive atmosphere for Native American students, as well as whoever else is interested in Native American culture as well.
So what's your particular, why are you at Stout? What are you studying?
So I'm actually double majoring in business administration and supply chain management.
Okay. Last month, the Native American Student Organization sponsored Native American Heritage Month at the university. What sorts of things did people experience?
We had one major event that we did. It was in the beginning of the month. We had two events in one day. One of them was a storytelling, traditional storytelling with Dylan Prescott. He's a Ho-Chunk and Potawatomi enrolled. And then we also had Elena Terry as well. She is Ho-Chunk enrolled, and she held a food demonstration. So she was cooking with indigenous ingredients and a lot of, actually, Ho-Chunk. She talks about seed saving. That was really cool.
One challenge for a non-native like myself when putting together a show like this is, who do you ask on the show, knowing that it's really unfair to ask any one or two or three people to represent an entire culture, or in the case of Native Americans, a number of cultures? But you said you feel a responsibility to share your culture. Does that feeling of responsibility ever feel overwhelming?
It does, actually. I was just thinking about that while I was planning these events, because we don't have many members in our Native American student organization, and that is because we don't have we have less than 1% of students attending UW-Stout identify as Native American.
What kind of specific number are we talking about there, 20?
About more or less than 100 students.
Oh, okay.
So, and that's out of about 9,000, I think.
But anyway, I interrupted you, but you were talking about the responsibility of trying to represent those people.
Yeah, and it's just really hard as well because, I mean, I did tell one of my, during our meetings, that there was over 500 federally recognized tribal nations in the United States, and that's only federally recognized as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we do have more than, I'm Ho-Chunk, and there's way more students. There's probably about three or four other tribes that attend here. So, I mean, it's hard to, you know, get all of that together, especially since there's 11 tribes in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Earlier this fall, a UW-Eau Claire student who is vice president of the Intertribal Student Council found a racist note on her dorm room door that said, "Go back to the red," and then an expletive. Do you ever worry that as a leader, someone who holds a higher profile at Stout, that you're at greater risk for discrimination?
Sometimes. I haven't faced anything myself, or I haven't seen anything myself here. But, I mean, I have heard comments about that incident after it happened, and one of my friends actually was really affected by it because they are from a reservation. Mm-hmm. And that student that was talking about it said that they don't think it's a big deal, and like, why is it being blown up, you know? So, I mean, it does affect us, even if it's a different student in a different, you know, university.
Yeah. Ariana Bourdon, UW Stout student who's president of the Native American Student Organization on that campus, is our guest right now. And you've been active in the community of Menominee as well as the Stout campus. You made a presentation last summer to the city council and successfully argued to change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day in the city of Menominee. Why is that sort of community involvement important to you?
It's important because, I mean, it does spread our awareness, and then it does get other people to fight for, you know, our rights, that we are still here, and that we are different cultures as well, too. So it was really, really nice. A small group called Menominee Cares actually played a big role in that as well. So that was really nice. And they've actually been coming to our meetings as well and educating themselves. So it's really nice to see that.
Now, you're originally from Wittenberg, just east of Wausau. Growing up, what did you learn at home about your heritage and culture, and what did you learn at school?
It was really different. Once in a while we did have, because we did have a strong community in Wittenberg, so we did bring our culture to elementary schools, middle schools, once in a great while, to educate those children about it. So they were exposed to it, which was really nice. But I did still face, like, racism at school, and I got called names sometimes. But then at home, it's almost a completely different world being with my own family because, I mean, we all have we're really close. And then in the community, too, we're really close with other families because we all kind of hold the same values and do the same traditions. So it was really different.
Thank you for joining us today. What are your plans post-college?
I'm hoping to be able to move to Green Bay, kind of a little closer to home, Wittenberg area, mm-hmm. To get a job there. And then my husband is also studying here as dietetics major as well. So hopefully he can get a job there too.
We've been speaking with Ariana Bourdon. She is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and she is the president of the Native American Student Organization at UW Stout. So great to have you on today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we will be hearing next from Catherine Thomas and her interview with Wendy McCoon's genius, UW Eau Claire professor who's doing her part to save the Ojibwe language from extinction. We are talking about Native American heritage here on the West Side. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is the Ideas Network. The Ojibwe language is an important part of Native American heritage, which is our topic here on the West Side this morning. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire is just one of just a few schools in the country that's offering college-level Ojibwe language studies. WPR's Catherine Thomas talked to Wendy McCoon's genius, associate professor of languages at UW-Eau Claire. Genius says she began learning Ojibwe herself as a child.
I was raised in Milwaukee. My ancestral background is mixed. My mom's family is a Cree and Métis from the Paw in Manitoba. My dad is Polish. I was raised by people who really wanted to bring the Ojibwe language back to our family. It's related to my ancestral language, and the other people around me were Ojibwe and Milwaukee. And they had me with them as a child, studying Ojibwe, even in university classes or non-credited ones. And so I got my undergrad degree, and Ojibwe wasn't offered at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where I went. and I wanted to learn, and I found there was a program at the University of Minnesota, so I applied to a PhD program so that I could fund my Ojibwe language studies, and here I am.
Very nice. So now you teach Ojibwe
at
UW-Eau Claire, and I understand that it is one of only two programs for the Ojibwe language in the UW system.
It's wonderful that the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire is supporting this endangered language program. We're really thrilled about it because, you know, traditionally places that are willing to have Ojibwe language classes, it's usually an adjunct professor that's teaching, and they're just temporary contracts, and there's no long-term commitment. So it's really great that Eau Claire's had this. And I had a predecessor, Larry Martin, before me who was teaching, and I think he started teaching Ojibwe in 2000, so it's been there quite a long time.
You teach a few language courses and also a course on culture and history. Can you tell us a little bit about those classes?
Yes, I teach and advise the Ojibwe Language Certificate Program. So students can take either 2 full years of language, which would be 16 credits, or they can take 3 semesters of language and 1 semester of a 3-credit Ojibwe culture and history class, and then they have 15-credit certificate. The language classes are really unique in that we're the only, indigenous language taught at the university, but we're also the only Ojibwe language program and the only language program here that is broadcasting on live stream on the internet. So you can check out our language department website and see our URL for that. But we're live. Right now it's once a day, Monday through Thursday, but when we have more classes, it's twice, 3 times a day sometimes. And we archive them, so you can watch the last couple of years on there for beginning Ojibwe 1 and 2 and intermediate Ojibwe 1 and 2. So it's really a great thing that the university is doing, and we have a huge part in Ojibwe language revitalization and in indigenous language revitalization, because we have people around the United States and Canada that are learning other languages or want to learn their ancestral language, or are working with an indigenous community, working with their families, and they write to us. We get a few emails every month on people who are either learning Ojibwe and using our site, or teaching it and looking at what we're doing, or learning another, teaching another indigenous language. So we've had a lot of impact around the U.S. and Canada in that way. My Ojibwe culture and history class is a pretty awesome class because it's something I inherited. My Ojibwe namesake was teaching in Milwaukee when I was a child, and she was teaching this ethnobotany class. And then my mother started teaching an ethnobotany class here, and she taught in Milwaukee later. And it's been sort of this class that's just evolved over several decades now, and we're the latest interpretation of it. So one teaching that we have in the culture is that when you're learning about a plant, for example, you should learn about that being, because they're considered living beings, just like humans in the culture and language. You're supposed to learn about that being with all as many senses as you can. So if it's poisonous, obviously you can't ingest it, but if it isn't, you can. So in the original class from the 1980s, when my namesake was teaching, they always had tea and to try to, remember the taste and the smell of the plants, because they couldn't always go outside and it's winter like it is, here. So we have this tea component, and nearly every class we have hot teas, and I've added iced tea to the class because it was easier to, we've got 50 people in a class, it's only so many kettles you can have, so we have iced and hot, so we've evolved since the 1980s, but we also have a lot of hands-on components. We work with plants and botanical materials and other things, cultural items, so that students can, get an appreciation for what these things are, so that when they're learning about a group, like we have a session on the Métis, the mixed bloods from Canada. There are people here, but they're recognized in Canada. And we make finger-woven belts, because that's a real proud symbol of this culture. And so the students learn about the Métis, but they're also making little bookmark versions of finger-woven belts. They can have that memory, too.
Let's talk about the language now. We've got the beginner Ojibwe and intermediate, and we've talked about that it's available online, and anybody can take advantage of that. You don't have to be a student. So I got to watch a couple of the archived classes. That was pretty cool. And you mentioned the efforts to revitalize native languages. How are they doing? What is their health status? How is Ojibwe doing right now?
Indigenous languages around the world are endangered, and there's different amounts of endangered, or actually they don't say dead, they say sleeping when you're talking about revitalization, but languages aren't spoken anymore. So there's different degrees of this. Ojibwe still is healthy in that we still have speakers. There are places where people are still using Ojibwe as a means, a language of communication. But in Wisconsin, we're, especially for Wisconsin dialect, we are really at a make or break point. And I'd say in Minnesota, we are too. One wonderful thing that Wisconsin has been doing for over a decade now is we have the very first Ojibwe immersion school, so that elementary school students can go to that and be taught all their subjects in Ojibwe, except they have to have English as a foreign language taught, or and there's some Wisconsin curriculum rules there. But that's under the Hayward School District. So there are these efforts. We don't know yet how that's going to pay off. We've got graduates of some of the schools already, of course, but you know, we don't know what's the future is going to be. Right now, we're still, in my opinion, really relying on that older generation, and we do lose fluent speakers who Ojibwe was their first language. We lose those people every year, so we're not out of the clear, but I think we have some hope.
This is Catherine Thomas, and I'm talking with Wendy McCoon's Genius. How does language play into culture?
Without the language, you have at best a watered-down version of the culture. And that's a real controversial thing to say. But within Ojibwe, for example, the entire worldview is in the language. And if you're describing cultural teachings in the language, you are already using that worldview to describe the worldview. When you're in English, you're describing the worldview, you really have to do a lot of explaining. You can't make the same kind of connections. An example, in Ojibwe and the Algonquian languages that's related to, we have categories of living and non-living, so animate and inanimate nouns. And you can't even make a sentence like to describe the appearance, like the color or the texture, or the taste of, you know, anything without knowing if you're talking about a living or non-living noun. And the categories are in many ways different than English. In English, we have this pronoun it, and it can be a living being or not, but it does divide. You know, so if you call a tree or an animal it, you're dividing it from humans. In Ojibwe, there isn't, that pronoun doesn't exist, the it for a living being. They're all he, she, or if it's it really is inanimate. So just that way of connecting these other forms of life that don't even exist in English, rocks, stones, pipes, drums, feathers, there's a whole list of some foods that are considered living in our language too. And then to not have this it pronoun, they're just a real different way of seeing the world. And you have to, even if you aren't part of that culture, don't believe in these things, you are having to go into it to talk. That's a big difference. Another huge one is that we don't have a third person. We have a third person, but we don't have a division there. So there is no he versus she. It's all he/she. There's a neen is me, geen is you, and ween is this he/she. That's a really different way of looking at the third person then as well. And it really suggests a time when the language was developing that there was, you know, more equality between the sexes. And that's a real, and that there were, for people who are today, there's debates and on our campus, there's a lot of talk about what pronouns to use, and students have put in their email, you don't use these pronouns when you speak about me. But in Ojibwe, there really isn't a choice. It's all this third person pronoun. There is no label on it. So it's a really different way of seeing the world and seeing other humans and other beings. That ween is also used for these other living beings that aren't humans too. So that's really, you know, really pulls everybody together as well.
I'm sure that we have some regional words that we would be familiar with that might come from the Ojibwe language. I'm thinking of Chippewa. What is the relationship between those two words? I might be wrong.
Chippewa is coming through possibly French into, from Ojibwe, possibly through French into English. And the written version of Ojibwe, when you look at the older texts, the way that when you read those, it sounds as Chippewa. So that's where the word is Ojibwe. In the language, Ojibwemowin is the name of the Ojibwe language. Shamingzek, Ojibwe Kwe, and Ojibwe Woman. So it's still abbreviated even as Chippewa or Ojibwe. But that one's obviously a written thing through multiple languages. And some of the people didn't actually speak that as their first language. These European languages are trading it. So it's interesting. But one that's really close here is Wasa, right? It's Wasa. It's just far away. So it's kind of a fun thing. And a few years ago, we had a reporter from the New York Times come to a language camp, but he was flying out of Wausau. And everybody at the camp was like, that means far away. And he was like, I know what Wausau means now. So that was kind of funny that like everybody told him that. Another one is Menominee is wild rice, and Menominee comes from that.
So the language is all around us.
Yeah, you see Gichigaming a lot on the signs when you get towards Duluth, because that's Lake Superior.
Right. Right.
That and the reservations there have their names, like, you know, you have Mijike Zaga Igining, it's up at Turtle Lake, and Odawa Zaga Igining is Lakutere, and you keep going up, Musquabicong is Red Cliff, Mushkazibing is Bad River.
Would you share some of the Ojibwe language with us so we can hear what it sounds like? If there are certain phrases or whatever you'd like to share, maybe something from a class that you would teach your students?
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd probably want to be able to say hello to people. So some people say bonjour, bonjour. And some people, especially when you get a little more south down here, you hear anin a little more, anin. And one that people always want to know in the class, and it's the most asked for tattoos, because people write into our program, we want to get a tattoo, is they do. They write it all the time for tattoos. It's gizagin, gizagin. It's I love you. Want that too? Some people say Gijuenamin. Gijuenamin. Nobody's tattooing that one on though. Gijuenamin is I love you or I care about you. It's the love that like a parent might have for a child or a spirit might have for us.
Who would have thought? Yeah. How do you feel about that? People using your language for tattoos.
Well, now I asked, are you going to get a tattoo? Because although we don't have a spelling system, there's, you know, the different bands and then looking at different communities, U.S. and Canada, nobody has one spelling system. We are using the double vowel spelling system at the school because a lot of the materials for learning Ojibwe and the online dictionary in it. So now when they ask me, I say, are you going to get tattooed? And I say, well, this is how you'd say, right, it's a double vowel because if you're just trying to say it, I might spell it differently for you, right? And then you're tattooed, right? So I don't care if you get a tattoo. I just don't want to be responsible for misspelling something. Uh-huh.
Kind of going back to your classes and your students, do you notice when they first come in, the first day of class or the first few classes, that you can pick up any misconceptions that they have, maybe because they didn't get much education in their earlier years in school about Native American people, or what they did learn maybe was incorrect or...
Yeah. Well, actually, part of my classes, we have in the culture class, it's already taught. Culture and history is taught in English. But the beginning Ojibwe 1 has multiple liberal education credits connected to it. So we have to have one credit that's dedicated to speaking English about language loss, revitalization, and colonization, decolonization. In those discussions in the beginning Ojibwe 1 class and in the language and culture, culture and history class, we have portion of it is, you know, what did you know about this history before? And what did you know about indigenous history before this class? And then if we have a topic, it's how did you understand this topic before you came to class? And there were a few years there, like 2 years ago, when the students in Minnesota had quite a bit of knowledge about colonization boarding schools, and the ones from Wisconsin didn't. And now we're back to neither group, seems like some curriculum changed in Minnesota and then changed back. And Wisconsin's pretty much been kind of stagnant. Every so often, if I get a student who's from near a reservation, they may have had some history, in some indigenous history in their class, and it may be more related to Wisconsin. But sadly, we're just not teaching this, even though there's mandates that we're supposed to be in the school system. So more what I usually hear the students saying is I've never heard of this. You know, it's not that I have a misconception of it. I've just never heard of it and that it wasn't covered in their classes. That's what usually the response is. I expected in the language class, I've always expected that people would think it was easy because they think of indigenous cultures as primitive. So the language is primitive. No one's actually come and said that when we discuss, like, what do you know about the language? That's positive they aren't saying that. And one thing we do in the class is we debunk stereotypes. So when you're trying to talk about, you know, are indigenous cultures primitive? Are they extinct? You are learning a language. You're seeing how complex Ojibwe is. You can really debunk that even in the beginning class. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful part of it as well. But more than anything, I just hear we didn't hear about this. And some students are angry about that. It's like, why wasn't I taught about boarding schools? You know, why didn't I learn about relocation, removal? You know, why wasn't I taught about those issues? And why don't I know what treaty rights are? And so that's what I hear more than anything.
Do you have objectives as a teacher for what you want your students to leave your classroom with at the end of the semester?
As a professor, what I hope they'll leave with is knowing a little more about Ojibwe language and culture, because we do the language and culture in both. And, you know, understanding that these are indigenous people of Wisconsin, and, you know, that indigenous people are still here. We're still around, and we're still very much part of the community today. That's what we're really hoping. And, you know, if they have some information to debunk some stereotypes, that would be wonderful, because then they can go and there's a ripple effect and teach the world.
Is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation we haven't talked about?
I just like people to know that we have these classes online and they're archived on there, and you can download the files. So please, on any social media, any connections you have in the community you're in, please let people know that we're broadcasting Ojibwe. my students, the first day, we don't broadcast the very first day of class because we explain what we're doing to them. And they're very proud to be helping language revitalization. We tell them, you know, even if you're never going to be using Ojibwe later, we hope you will, but if you aren't in your later studies, you are now part of language revitalization on these recordings we're making of you. So they're very happy to be there. I know they try really hard to be enthusiastic and happy when we have a song-based curriculum. They're happily singing along, and they're doing that. So please, you know, I don't want to say take advantage of it, but take advantage of it and download these things and watch. Learn some Ojibwe with us. We'd really love to teach you.
And that's through the UW-Eau Claire website.
Yeah, on the Department of Languages website.
Well, Wendy McCoon's Genius, thank you very much for your time.
Miigwech.
That's UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Languages, Wendy McCoon's Genius, who sat down with the West Side's producer, Catherine Thomas, to talk about efforts to teach and revitalize the Ojibwe language on that campus. To access the online lessons, go to uwec.edu and search Ojibwe. Thanks also to our guests earlier this hour, journalist Paul DeMaine of Hayward, who after 33 years wrapped up the News from Indian Country publication in the summer of 2019, and the president of UW Stout's Native American student organization, Ariana Bordon. Next week on the West Side, the former host of the program returns as my guest. WPR reporter Rich Kramer joins me to talk about the in-depth report that comes out next week about the status of the gray wolf in Wisconsin and what that means to farmers, hunters, and environmentalists in our area. Thanks for joining us today on the West Side. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.